The J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.
He's taken down on the edge of the area, but the referee had a very good view there. Chris B said there was no foul. But Japan have played on here. They did it. And it's Japan who take the lead. Asako. And he may hit the target. Well saved. Gone to right beneath the crossbar. Big, big moment in the Asian Cup of 2019. It's 2-0 Japan. Asako is their hero. Many blue shirts are around in here once again. And that's the goal that sends Japan into the final.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk podcast for the first time in 2019. I'm Ben Maxwell. Late on Monday night, Japan time, the Samurai Blue made it through to the final of the Asian Cup with a 3-0 win over Iran. And on this special episode of the pod, I'm joined by Sam Robson of Football Radar and Paul Williams of the Asian Game podcast to talk about the semi-final triumph and Japan's prospects in the final against opponents Qatar. The J-Talk podcast starts now. It's a new year of the pod, and we're going to extremes with our two guests. Firstly, our most frequent of 2018, Sam Robson, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Happy New Year to everyone. It's great to be back.
Great to have you back on, Sam. And next to a man making his first J-Talk appearance in what we both believe is about 5.5 years. The last time we believe was in June of 2013. But there can be no one more qualified to talk about the Asian Cup as he's lived it for the past month, coming to us direct from the UAE. It's Paul Williams. Paul, how are you?
Glad to be back on, Ben. It's good to join you.
Yes, the last time we spoke on the pod, Paul, as I said, June 2013, we had a couple of beers at a bar in Shinjuku and talked about a World Cup qualifier between Japan and Australia. And, yes, well, one of those countries is still in action in the Asian Cup, and that's what we're here to talk about. Before we get into what happened on Monday night in terms of the Iran game, and, yes, obviously we will look ahead to the final, I wanted to get you both to share how this tournament has gone for you. As I said in my long-winded intro there, Paul, you have been following the Asian Cup from on the ground in the UAE. So you've been there the entire time, and what a fantastic experience it must have been for you.
It certainly has been. It feels like a long month and a short month all at the very same time. The tournament seems to have flown by. I can't believe that we're pretty much at the final already. It has been quite an experience to be here on the ground. It's probably safe to say it hasn't been the best Asian Cup in terms of the quality on the pitch and off the pitch. There's been some things that have left a little to be desired. Some of the crowds and the general engagement around the host cities hasn't been the best it could possibly be. There wasn't that real tournament feel that you want to get when you host a major tournament like this. But nonetheless, it's been a fantastic experience. Some of the football has been brilliant, not always from Japan, mind you. I'm quite surprised they've made it all the way to the final. They're slowly built into it. Their best performance was that against Iran, which we'll get onto shortly. But yeah, it's fantastic to be on the ground. I was at the game last night between the UAE and Qatar, and that was one of the only games this tournament where there was a real edge to the atmosphere. There was a big build-up. We got to the stadium about 3 hours before kickoff, and already there was a huge crowd piling in. You could sense there was a real edge around that game, and it certainly played out that way. When you saw some of the scenes when Qatar scored their goals and bottles and shoes were raining down, it was quite the experience to be a part of. And now we just wait and see what happens when the final comes around on Friday.
Indeed. So you've been over there for work, Paul. So I imagine in the early days of the tournament, when, you know, there are pretty much games every day, you would have been pretty flat out and, you know, running around here, there and everywhere trying to put stories together, etc. So has it only been in the knockout stages where the games are a bit more spread out that you're actually able to put your feet up a little bit and actually really relax and enjoy the football?
A little bit, still work going on. But as you said, in the early stages of the tournament, when there's three games each day, it's a little bit difficult to actually keep a track of everything that's happening. And ironically enough, if I was home in Australia, I probably would have got to watch more of the Asian Cup than I have actually over here. Not only for the fact that it's not on TV much, because Bein Sports isn't shown much on in the UAE, but also for the fact that, as you said, you're just running around. You're at different press conferences, different training sessions, which often conflict with when the games are on. So you're sometimes only seeing, one game a day rather than the three games a day that I would be watching if I was back at home. And it was certainly a busy time. And yes, certainly towards the latter stages when the games are a little bit more spread out. Certainly for the semifinals, I was able to, luckily enough, to be able to attend both semifinals and kind of just put my feet up and relax and enjoy that, even though I was working at the UAE Qatar game. It wasn't a very stressful evening, so I was able to just sit back and enjoy the football and take in the occasion.
Terrific stuff. So, yeah, no sandals thrown in your direction, I gather, at the Qatar-UAE game then. And so, Sam, we know that, you got onto your holidays earlier than expected thanks to Kashima Antlers winning the ACL and needing to be involved in the Club World Cup, which brought forward the end of the Emperor's Cup at the end of 2018. So have Football Radar put you straight to work at the start of this new year? Have you been following the Asian Cup from the start, in particular Japan games, and also have they rounded you up for some from other countries to follow?
Yeah, I kind of got a mixed bag of countries. I had Japan, of course, and then Saudi Arabia, Syria and Palestine were my selection for this Asian Cup. So I've seen the best and the worst of the Asian Cup, because that Syria-Palestine game was one of the worst games I've ever seen. But yeah, straight to work. I've really enjoyed it, to be honest. This is the first Asian Cup that I've actually covered. I've kind of dipped in and out of the last Asian Cup in Australia. So I've watched most of the games, not all of them. And I think the quality in general has been okay. I mean, you've seen the likes of North Korea get thrashed a little bit. But some of the other lesser teams, I would say, like Turkmenistan, put in a great performance against Japan in Japan's opening game. So I have enjoyed seeing them. Kind of the different countries come around. I've enjoyed Qatar's play as well. They've been superb throughout most of the tournament. And Japan finally gave us a performance in the last game. So it's definitely building up towards a good final.
Most definitely. All right then. So, yeah, you guys have had a fantastic time. But I must admit, this tournament has been a bit of a slow burn for me, myself. Obviously, I was very much in off-season mode when the tournament started and Japan played their first game. I actually forgot what time the match kicked off. I flicked over onto TV Asahi and there you go, Turkmenistan were winning 1-0, and I wondered what the hell was going on. That came, of course, a couple of days after Australia had lost their opener to Jordan, and I wondered what sort of a tournament we were going to be in for. I also was frantically looking around for Shoya Nakajima on the pitch, Sam, and I couldn't find him, and I had to scroll through Dan Orlowicz's Twitter posts to find out that he'd pulled out through injury in the week before the tournament. So that shows you how prepared I was for the start of the Asian Cup, and that's one of the reasons why this is our first podcast of the tournament. And Paul, I wanted to get your thoughts on how I don't want to rub this in for any Iran supporters listening, and I must give a massive amount of credit to the Golbezan guys for all their work throughout the tournament. But I mean, that you couldn't have had a more contrasting couple of teams coming into this game, could you, in terms of how things ended up panning out? Because obviously Japan came in after winning all five of their games, it must be said, but all by a single goal, including unconvincing 1-0 wins over Saudi Arabia in the round of 16 and then also Vietnam in the quarterfinals, whereas Iran had, obviously genuine hopes that this could be their time under Carlos Quiroz. They had beaten Oman 2-0 in the round of 16. They swept aside China 3-0 in the quarters. And, yeah, coming up against a seemingly off-colour Japan, having not conceded a goal all tournament, I mean, they had to be so confident heading in, surely, Paul.
They certainly were. I was confident that they were going to get the result as well. I think most people were. I made a comment that came to smack me in the face after their win against China. I put out a tweet asking who will play Iran in the final, because I just couldn't see how, based on the performances that we'd seen up until that point, how Japan were going to be able to defeat Iran. Some people had said when we were discussing it here on the ground with different people, that they were they were not worried, but they didn't think Iran were going to be able to get the job done because they hadn't actually been tested up until that point. You know, most of the teams they'd played, they'd been able to sweep aside quite easily. And while I'd certainly agree that that was the case, I would agree that that was the case for Japan as well. And Japan had actually struggled in that process, whereas Iran had actually looked quite dominant. So going into that game, I was confident that Iran would be able to get the job done and they'd go through to their first final. And I thought based on what I'd seen, them and probably Qatar had been the two most informed teams. And it was just, I made the comment on the podcast when the previous series that we did on the Asian game with Scott McIntyre before the tournament, that there were question marks over Iran and their tactics coming into this tournament. It looked like those fears had been allayed, but they were laid bare in that semi-final loss against Japan. They were one-dimensional. They missed Mehdi Taremi, which was a big loss for them. And in hindsight, it was a bigger loss than I thought it might have been. I thought they might have brought in Karim Ansarifard as almost as a direct replacement, but instead Kalos Kiroš has reverted to type and gone for a more defensive kind of lineup, and they were just exposed badly. There was a time during the first half where, you know, one of the times they didn't just look to lump the ball up to Sardar Azmoun. They tried to get him in behind, but the ball was played in and it was Azmoun against, five Japanese players, and he was never going to win that battle. And that was the problem that they had on the night, was that he was so isolated up front that he had no support coming from midfield. It was very much, as I said, a typically Kalos Kiroš performance where it was defensive and pragmatic, and that was their downfall in the end. They had no go in attack apart from getting the ball out wide, whipping it in and hoping that Azmoun would get his head onto it. But the Japanese defence, Yoshida and Tomiyasu in the middle particularly, they just ate that for breakfast. That was child's play for them, and Iran had no answer. They were one-dimensional, and when their game plan wasn't working, they had nothing else to revert to, whereas Japan were able to find space in between the lines quite comfortably and just pick Iran apart. And, you know, they got a little bit of luck with the first two goals, you could say, but they were dominant up until that point, and they deserved the lead and they deserved the win.
Absolutely. All right, well, Sam, well, let's briefly talk about how things had panned out throughout the tournament from the Japan perspective before we go blow by blow through the semi-final. I mentioned that, I was frantically looking for Shoya Nakajima. I mean, do you think part of the slow start that Japan endured in this tournament, I mean, when I say slow start, I mean literally five games where they looked out of sorts. I mean, do you put part of that down to the rest of the starting 11 having to get used to playing without Nakajima? Obviously, he had become the attacking fulcrum of the side in the early days of Hajime Moriyasu's reign. How much of it also do you put down to Yuya Osako's injury hit tournament? Because obviously he wasn't fit to start either the round of 16 game or the quarterfinal against the Vietnam. He came in for the semi-final. He was able to make it for that game, and we saw the difference he made throughout the entire game. So is there anything else? Or obviously, feel free to expand on those two players if you like, but is there anything else you can put it down to? Because obviously Japan had been in, while the opposition hadn't been stellar, they had been in, you know, some pretty decent form coming into the tournament. And I think their slow start probably took a lot of us by surprise.
Yeah, I think there's so many factors towards this. I think Japan came in quite undercooked. They had no pre-tournament friendlies, so most of the Japanese-based players hadn't played for a month. Some of the European players, like Yoshida, had come in off the Christmas period, which is quite tough. Others, like Gaku Shibasaki, are not really playing for Hetafe, so not many of this squad had much football coming into the tournament. Then they got the injuries to the likes of Nakajima. Then they lost Kento Misao, Idomasa Morita, and Takuma Asano all before the tournament. For the first game as well, Endo was ill, so they had to move Tomiyasu into midfield. So there were so many different changes to the way that Japan had set up in the previous friendlies, where they'd had quite a settled team. They kind of built a rhythm with that team. And then Osaka was injured as well. He had that hip injury, I think it was, coming into the tournament. He managed to play through the Turkmenistan game, scored two goals, and then was out. And then if you look at the striking options without Osaka, I mean, Muto tries very hard. He makes a lot of runs, but he's not got that physical presence up front. He hasn't got the ability to hold the play up like Osaka does, to bring in the likes of Minamino and Doan, etc. And then Kitagawa as well was the other striker in there. And I thought he had a very good season for Espoirs last season, but I think this is too much of a step up for him. He's looked out of his depth in every game that he's played, which is unfortunate, but he hasn't really cut it at this level, which is... Yeah, so Japan have took their time to get into it. I think some of the games against in the group were always very winnable, but so Japan didn't have to get out of first gear. They sort of, I mean, they got kind of panned for the Saudi Arabia performance, where I think it was like 24% possession. But I don't know if I'm giving too much credit to Moriyasu, but the way that he set up very defensively really worked against Saudi Arabia, because they have a lot of possession, but kind of possession for possession's sake. They don't really have a striker up front who's going to score goals. They play Al-Mawalad, who's really a winger. So they're a lot of interchange and nice, neat play in front of the defence, but they never looked like threatening or penetrating the back line. And so I thought that was a decent performance for Japan. I thought against Vietnam, I thought it was poor. I thought first half they decided to play long balls up to Kitagawa, which was never going to work. I don't know why they stepped away from the kind of direct dynamic forward passing that they used in the friendlies. And then against Iran, I thought the performance against Iran was exactly how Japan should have been playing throughout the entire tournament. And perhaps they were just doing enough to get through. Maybe that's, again, being a little too generous. But I thought they seemed to have built a little bit into this tournament, and then a superb performance in the semi-final.
All right, well, yeah, I tweeted at kickoff. I wondered, if this would be the end of the road for Moriyasu and his squad. But, yeah, if they had one convincing performance in them, this would be a great time to show it. And, fortunately, they were able, to not only get the result, but, yeah, play well doing it and go into the final with a fair whack of confidence. Now, Paul, yeah, again, we're going to go through this blow by blow, but I want to get a sense of the atmosphere at the Hazza Bin Zayed Stadium in the lead up to the game. I think you tweeted that you were originally weren't intending to make it along to that game, but you were, you decided to, and I presume you must have been glad that you did. And how did things build up during the afternoon, and the atmosphere inside the ground? I'm sure it was terrific.
Yeah, well, certainly, as you said, I wasn't planning to be there. I was based in Abu Dhabi at the time, which is probably about a 90-minute to 2-hour drive away. And at that stage, I thought I was going to be based here. There was potential for training sessions and press conferences to conflict. But as it turns out, that Qatar's press conference did conflict with that, but I wasn't on duty for that one. So I had the afternoon free. I had a friend that was driving to LA for the game as well, so I hitched a ride with him and made our way there. As for the atmosphere and the build-up to the game, I can't tell you anything about that because we got to the stadium literally as kickoff was happening, so I'm not sure about what the build-up was like, but certainly the atmosphere inside the stadium during the game itself was just unbelievable, completely all generated by the Iranian fans. There was only a small, very small pocket of Japanese fans, probably, 1,000 people at most. The rest of the 20,000-strong crowd was all Iranian fans, and they made an exceptional racket, as they have done throughout the tournament. They've been one of the fan bases during the tournament that has turned out in large numbers and in fine voice as well, and they were certainly that way on whatever day it was. I can't even remember what day it was now.
Monday.
It's Wednesday, and I'm not even sure what day that was. Monday, I think it was. Yeah, so they provided a fantastic atmosphere. The sad thing for them, not so much for those listening to this podcast that are Japanese fans, sad thing for them was their team turned in their worst performance and couldn't send them home happy. But certainly, yeah, the atmosphere inside the stadium, it's probably one of the best stadiums anywhere in Asia, let alone, within the country itself. Just provides such a fantastic atmosphere. The roof helps trap the noise in as well, and you're nice and close to the pitch, perfect sight lines. It was a brilliant evening. Glad I was able to make it along in the end and witness it, because I hadn't seen a lot of Japan this tournament because their games were often in cities where I wasn't based, so and their games often conflicted with other duties that I had, so I'd only been able to see highlights here and there of their performances. That was the first time I'd got to see them live, so perhaps I'm something of a good luck omen for them.
Absolutely. Well, Paul, I'll come straight back to you because, I mean, yeah, it was curious to me. Obviously, yeah, Iran had gotten the results and had come into the semi-final in a richer vein of form, it can't be argued, than Japan. So, I mean, what do you put it down to, their semi-final flop? There were definitely half chances for them in the first half. And, I mean, even after Japan had luckily gone 1-0 up, I mean, there was a great free kick from I knew I was going to struggle to pronounce his name, Jahanbakhsh.
The Jahanbakhsh?
Yeah. Jahanbash. I hear Premier League commentators say it all the time, and for some reason I've just got a frog in my throat when I try and say it. But, I mean, they were still in the game at 1-0 down, obviously, before the penalty. But, yeah, they just, they failed to convince, really, the entire evening, didn't they? And so what do you put that down to? We know how much a trophy like this would have meant to the people of Iran and, to most likely round off Carlos Quiroz's time in charge of Team Melli. So the fact that they just weren't able to turn up on the evening and put on their best performance, I mean, it'll haunt them for years, I'm sure. But I mean, is there anything that you can directly put it down to? Pressure that Japan put on them in areas of the pitch that they weren't expecting? Did Japan have more control of the game than you were expecting them to, and did that limit what Iran were able to do? Or do you think their plan all along was to try and hit Azmoun on the counter, and that simply that Yoshida and Tomiyasu were equal to the task, as you mentioned a while ago as we were chatting?
I think what the issue for Iran was that they were just too – Azmoun was too isolated up front, and we've seen this often be the case with Iran before. I mentioned it before that Carlos Quiroz is very much a pragmatic, defensive kind of coach, which generally works well when he's perhaps at the World Cup and he's coming up against teams like Spain and Portugal, who you expect are going to control and dominate the game. When you come here to the Asian Cup, when you're one of the favourites to win the tournament, I'm not sure you can get away with playing that style of football. It doesn't really work. You know, they're on the same level as Japan. There's no reason they should sit off and play such a defensive-minded game as they did and as they do. So I certainly think that was one of the issues. They certainly missed Mehdi Taremi. As I said, when he was suspended for that game, I didn't realise how much they would miss him. It's his physical presence up front, the work rate that he has. He doesn't always take the chances that come his way. He's been quite wasteful this tournament. And so has Sardar Azmoun, to be fair. They've had a lot of chances. They probably should have scored more goals than what they have. But the work rate he has across that front third, the physical presence he provides, they effectively had a two-man attack, whereas once Taremi dropped out, he opted to just leave Azmoun isolated up front. He brought Vahid Amiri into the side, but he dropped a little bit deeper, so it was effectively playing almost like a 4-5-1 system, and Azmoun was just too isolated up front. And I think Japan were able to just get control of the ball, as they can tend to do, and Iran found it difficult then to actually play through and find the spaces, and they were just resorting to long balls and pumping it up to Azmoun, and Tomiyasu and Yoshida were quite comfortable with that. So I think that's where they lost it. I don't know whether they just got a little bit of stage fright, if you will. They should have gone out with a more attacking mentality. I would have played Karim Ansarifard up alongside Sardar Azmoun and really attacked the game from the start, because, you know, we've seen Japan this tournament, you know, they're happy to sort of sit back and let other teams take control of the game. And I thought that was Iran's opportunity to do that. And they've got the players and the quality to do that, but it's not the game style that Carlos Quiroz deploys, and he reverted to type. And I think that just allowed Japan then to play themselves into the game. And as I said, they are able to find space easily between the lines. They're able to get the fullbacks in behind and getting in crosses and cause all sorts of issues. You saw as well, you know, a little bit of naivety as well when five players all charged towards the ref to protest a free kick that wasn't actually paid. The Japanese players played the whistle and the Iranian defenders were all caught out of position. And from that moment on, that kind of symbolised their game. They were just they were erratic when they needed to be calm, and they weren't quite as controlled as they could have been, and they'll rue this missed opportunity, because they've certainly got a squad that's good enough to compete at this level, that should have been able to go on and win the title that perhaps you could say they've deserved, given how good they've been in Asian football over the last 5, 6, 7 years. But they really bottled it. I think it was more down to them. Japan certainly played their best game of the tournament, but I think certainly a lot of the blame rests on Iran themselves. Japan were good, but Iran, have they played to their potential? Certainly could have done better than what they did in this game.
Indeed, and yes, as I said, that will gnaw away at the players and indeed the all of the supporters of the Iran national team for years to come, I'm sure, until they have a chance to right things at the next Asian Cup. Sam, one of the things that I don't know how closely you were following it in the lead up to the tournament or not, there are a couple of selection issues for Hajime Moriyasu, and one of them was deciding on his first choice goalkeeper, and the fact that he's gone for Shuichi Gonda has maybe pleased some, and got a few people, a few other people, a little bit frustrated as they're not massive fans of Gonda. But for me, obviously, as an FC Tokyo supporter, I saw him come through with Tokyo as a young goalkeeper, unseating Hitoshi Shiota and making that number one shirt his own from a very early age. He basically came straight into the club and took the number one shirt. And obviously, his personal problems over the years have been well documented, but for me it's great to see him for the moment anyway entrenched as Japan's number one. And slightly rash pass aside that actually helped set up Iran for their best chance of the first half. As I say, apart from that, I thought he was pretty much flawless on Monday night. An early claim at the edge of his box in the third minute at the feet of Azmoun, I think, helped set the tone for his evening and, maybe gave him a little bit of confidence to get through the match. And for the majority of it, I thought he's terrific. He, commanded his area, knew when to catch, knew when to punch, and, pretty much got everything right. Obviously, he could have been embarrassed with that chance for Azmoun in the 22nd minute, but then at the end of that passage of play, he was the one redeeming himself with a save for with the outside of his left foot that deflected Azmoun's shot out for a corner. So for me, it was terrific to see Gonda. For now, as I say, establish himself as Japan's number one. How did you think he's gotten on throughout the tournament, and in particular on Monday night in the semi final?
I think he's gone the same way as Japan, really. I think he started off very shakily and has grown into the tournament, and Monday was his best performance. I was a little surprised to see him given the number one jersey, but I thought maybe Higashiguchi was finally his time to have the number one shirt for the duration of a tournament. But Gonda probably earned it with the way he performed, especially the second half of the last season. I think if it wasn't for him, Sagan Tosu would probably have been relegated. That's how good he was. So I was happy for him that he got his chance against Turkmenistan, the first goal, like 40-yarder or whatnot, he should save. And then for the rest of the games, like, he was a little nervous. I think the defence in front of him was a little nervous for a lot of them. Even Maya Yoshida, who should be the calming presence in that back line, was playing kind of errant back passes to him, not really helping him out. But he's managed to overcome that. I thought it was pretty good against Saudi Arabia, and then okay against Vietnam, but still shaky. But as you say, I think it was almost flawless against Iran. That one pass out was dodgy, but it was the only mistake he really made, and he made up for it with a good save afterwards. He, as you said, his command of his area is probably his best trait that I've seen in this tournament. I don't think he has ever not come for a cross and not got there. He's always got the defence out of the way. He's always taken control of that situation, which is what your defence wants. So I'm glad that he's kind of impressed in this tournament. He's managed to get him a move to Portugal with Porto Moinense, so he might wave to Shoya Nakajima as he exits at the same time.
Yeah, Nakajima's probably already over there in the Gulf Tour to finalise his transfer. So he might have even joined up with the squad ahead of the final to be their number one cheerleader or something.
Yeah, maybe. We might get on to Nakajima later, but yeah, that's an interesting transfer. But for Gonda, I'm glad he's got a second crack at Europe. I mean, he went to SV Horn in Austria just after his troubles at FC Tokyo, and it didn't really work out for him. But he's done really well to kind of rebuild his career at Sagan Tosu, and I hope everything goes well for him back in Portugal.
Indeed, then. So, yes, as I mentioned, Gonda made an important claim at the edge of his box in the third minute. And it must be said, I tweeted at halftime that I didn't really think Iran were in the game, Paul. But watching the highlights back again today in preparation for our chat, I mean, there weren't a massive amount of chances, but almost all of the half chances came for Iran in the first half. But as we've mentioned a couple of times already, basically it was Tomiyasu and Yoshida both being in the right place at the right time to deny Azmoun, who was the sole outlet for Iran, and basically, and you can see why. I mean, he's a terrific player, obviously, and the chance that he created for himself, basically, in the 22nd minute. I mean, he turned to Gaku Shibasaki inside out, and his shot went through Yoshida's legs before drawing that terrific low save from Gonda. So, I mean, the first half hour especially, I mean, yeah, the half chances were coming for Iran more so than for Japan. Just before the 20 minutes are up, Ritsu Doan dribbled a mishit shot just wide. But I don't know, for me, yeah, watching the game, and again, full disclosure, and if anybody wants to come back at me with criticism about Gonda, I mean, I'm going to have to wear it, because full disclosure, I mean, this was the first game that I'd watched from start to finish throughout the tournament for Japan. So maybe, like Paul, maybe I'm a good luck charm as well, and I've just touched wood, because we probably double jinxed that, Paul. But, yeah, I mean, the first half hour anyway, it was fairly even, but for me, I was really pleased with how controlled Japan were. And from what I'd read and the bits that I'd seen of the previous games in the tournament, it seemed that, yeah, Japan had, taken a measure of control from the start that I was pleased to see. And as I say, I was worried that they might have been overrun by Iran, but there was basically no sign of that from the start, was there?
There wasn't, no. As you said, I thought the same as well. I thought Japan took control of that match, even though Iran had their chances. I thought most of those came on the break or from Jimmy, you know, Japan turning the ball over. So, yeah, I was like you. I thought Japan had control of the match early, and they controlled it throughout the game as well, that early chance to Azmoun. And when you look at it, that was, you know, them being able to sort of get in behind the defences, and that's something they didn't try and do enough of, in my opinion. As I said, too often they just went long and just lumped the ball forward, and it was just very lazy, very predictable football, which made it easy for the Japanese defence. They didn't try to mix it up a little bit and try and play the ball along the ground, try and get their players in behind the Japanese defence, or play through the Japanese defence. You know, because certainly there was the potential for them to do that. You know, we saw, as I said, Azmoun get behind and force that fine save from Gonda, and I was certain that one was going in. I thought I was just waiting for the back of the net to ripple, and I was already almost out of my seat expecting it to be a goal, and a beautiful save, fine save from that one. And how different the game could have been had that one gone in, because we know how much Iran like to sit back and defend, and how capable they are of doing so. Had they taken a 1-0 lead, then all of a sudden the complexion of that match changes. So certainly you have to give credit to Shuichi Gonda. As you said, it's perhaps a surprise inclusion as the starting goalkeeper in this squad, but a couple of troubles early on against Turkmenistan and that, but he certainly stood tall in this game, and I guess that justifies the selection from Mariasu to make him his number one for the tournament.
Most definitely. So we're going to come on to the two goals that put Japan in control of this game just after the hour mark in a second. But before we do that, Sam, I want to give you a chance to pay credit, if you are so inclined, and I presume you will be, to Takehiro Tomiyasu and Maya Yoshida for the way that they corralled Sada Azmoun, again, that one glorious chance aside in the 22nd minute throughout this game. I mean, Paul mentioned earlier, I mean, the quality of the opposition that Iran had to face on their way to the semi-final. So perhaps the fact that there wasn't that much of a plan B might have been related to that. I'm not sure. I mean, some of those balls that were getting cut out by Tomiyasu and Yoshida in the first half, they might have been the sort of balls that were coming off for them earlier on in the tournament. So if it was a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, then they were backing Azmoun in to get the better of his duels with Japan's two centre-backs. But on the evening, when they needed to stand up, they most certainly did. And, well, Tomiyasu's been one of the revelations of the tournament, surely.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Against China for Iran, Azmoun had a terrific game, but he bullied the Chinese defence, and they kind of buckled under the pressure of Azmoun, and he just ran riot in that game. But that didn't happen here with Tomiyasu and Yoshida. I thought the key part was maybe 5 minutes in. They played the first through ball down the channel towards Azmoun, but Tomiyasu was perfectly placed. He cuts it out, pushes him off the ball, clears it away, and he kind of put his stamp on the game right away with that. And then he was unflustered throughout the entire game. I mean, they did over-rely on Asmund, and everything was kind of launched long towards him, and he targeted the 20-year-old, because on paper that's what you would do. But Tomiyasu has had a fantastic year in Belgium with St. Trudens, and he's carried that form on to the national team, and he was so good in this game. The only time Asmund really got in was because of a Gonder error, and it wasn't really Tomiyasu's fault at all, that one. But for the rest of the game, and he just dominated Asmund, and Asmund just got more and more frustrated as the game went on, which, as well as them conceding goals as well, and he was kind of flicking out and a little slap around the ear, I think he did. But yeah, fantastic performance from Tomiyasu. And Yoshida, I thought that was his best game as well of the tournament. As I said before, he was a little flustered in a lot of the earlier games, making kind of uncharacteristic mistakes, and he can be caught out with his lack of pace. That's a problem for Yoshida, and it's how some teams have got against him. But in this one, again, he kind of took a little bit of a step back. He had his positioning right. The communication was perfect with Tomiyasu and with Endo from most of the... Well, while Endo was on the pitch, he was the one just kind of covering in front of Yoshida to allow Yoshida to drop back, and then Nagatomo to his left side, he cuts out the long balls as well. He comes in, clears the header. So I thought collectively it was a superb Japanese defensive performance, which is not something we always say about Japan. But yeah, and Tomiyasu especially has been probably the defender of the tournament, in my opinion. I know Kim Min-jae's got a lot of plaudits for South Korea, but for me, Tomiyasu, in every game he's played, even when he was in midfield in that first game, I think he has been absolutely superb.
So Sam, a quick question. Without notice, Japan's, let's touch wood that Japan make it to the World Cup in Qatar in 2022, but who would be your starting centre-backs for Japan if you were put on the spot? And I'm going to put you on the spot right now. You have to pick two out of Yoshida, Tomiyasu and Gen Shoji. Who are your two at the moment?
For 3 years' time, I'd go Tomiyasu and Shoji. I think Shoji's move to Toulouse in France will really help him step up an extra level. I think he had a very good performance in Toulouse's last game after maybe a shaky start, but I think he'll really come on. He's perfect for the left-hand side, and Tomiyasu is the right-sided centre-back. I think that would be my centre-back pairing.
I was kind of leading you in that direction. I was hoping you were going to say that, because I think it's the right answer as well. But yes, well, obviously a lot of water has to go under the bridge before then. But for the moment anyway, Tomiyasu's emergence has been a massive boon for Japan. And yes, after Shoji was so impressive at the World Cup, they haven't really missed a beat in the centre of defence. Well, at least on Monday night, and hopefully in the final as well. That will continue. Now, sorry, Paul, just bear with me for a sec. I'm going to go straight back to Sam, because you've already mentioned your thoughts on the incident that saw Japan take the lead in the 56th minute, where basically five Iranian defenders stopped, and that allowed Takumi Minamino, who had taken a bit of a theatrical tumble, it must be said, on the edge of the box. But yes, it allowed him to dust himself off, race to the corner to pick up the ball, turn on a sixpence and curl in a perfect cross for the unmarked Yuya Osako to head in from 6 yards. I mean, Sam, this was just Keystone Cops sort of stuff. And, I mean, yeah, obviously for Iran, for this to be the goal that started your downfall, I mean, it's an absolute horror show. It's Keystone Cops all over. But I mean, if you've ever played football, you play to the whistle, and those five guys are going to have to live with that moment for as I've said a couple of times, years and years to come, aren't they?
Yeah, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. For all of the teams in the Asian Cup, for Iran to be the team to kind of mess up like this, I mean, they're the most defensively disciplined probably in the tournament. But play to the whistle, lads. What are you doing? I mean, complaining about a free kick that's not been given, and they're all just standing around. It was ridiculous. I've never seen anything like it. But, I mean, credit to Minamino. I mean, not necessarily for the tumble, but for the reaction. He was alive, the only one in the situation that was alive to it. He's had a pretty dodgy tournament. I mean, the amount of chances he's missed is incredible. But fantastic awareness maybe to get up and get the ball, great cross into Osaka, but my word, Iran, I mean, I don't think that any of them involved in that is ever going to live that down. It was absolutely ridiculous.
And then they looked for a way back into the game, Paul, and Alireza Jahanbakhsh free kick, and apologies to the way I mispronounced his name earlier. I think that was a fair attempt at it on the, what was that, probably the, about the fifth try. I had four goes earlier on. His free kick was punched away. It looked like it was heading for the top corner before Gonda got across to keep it out. That was 5 minutes after Japan took the lead. And then just 2 minutes later, I guess, another controversial moment in the game. But, I mean, the referee had a fantastic look at the initial handball and he was fairly strong in his decision to award the penalty in the first place and then being called over to VAR and, confirming his original decision. So, again, I mean, well, for the first goal, Iran, they can't feel hard done by, but they can feel embarrassed by how it came about. On this occasion, I guess you can see an argument where some people would say it wasn't a deliberate handball, but if a player slides in like that on the floor with his arm out and the ball hits his arm, I mean, 9 times out of 10, those are given, aren't they? And it's hard luck for Team Melli. But, it's just another one of those. It just makes the loss even more difficult to swallow, doesn't it?
It does. I don't think they can have too many complaints about the penalty decision. I think most are of the view that it probably is a penalty. Obviously, there's the law that says, you know, it has to be a deliberate handball. But as you said, 9 times out of 10, that is actually, that's a decision that's actually paid and goes in favour of the attacking team. Funnily enough, there's been stories floating around here when you talk to people that the referees have actually been instructed in an attempt to try and diffuse situations to kind of use VAR just to kind of diffuse the situation and take some time out of the game and let everything settle down. And I guess to show that, you know, they're giving it a second look and still confirming their decision, whether that was the case there, because I'm not sure why the VAR would otherwise need to get involved in that decision, because it certainly wasn't a clear and obvious error that is the benchmark to overturn such a decision. So I think that one was pretty clear cut, and as soon as Osako converted that penalty, there was certainly going to be no coming back for Iran. When they were still 1-0 down, they obviously still had hope. They just needed to get a goal on the break. But even then, I thought it probably looked a little bit unlikely. And without wanting to preempt things, obviously Haraguchi got the goal at the end. But by that stage, I think it was still 2-0. It was about 10-15 minutes to go. I turned sitting next to a favourite of the podcast in Sean Carroll at the game, and said to him that, you know, Japan are going to score 2 or 3 more goals here, because Iran were pushing numbers forward in the attempt to try and score goals and were getting caught at the back. And Alireza Birinvand, the Iranian goalkeeper, said as much to a colleague of mine in the mix zone after the game, that had the game gone on another 10 minutes, they would have lost 5-0 because they were just getting opened up too easily at the back. So as the game wore on, Japan's control became ever and ever more apparent.
Terrific. So, well, that's great to hear that you were having a chat to Sean. How's he going over there? He hasn't had any jabs in the bum on this occasion. I hope, as to what happened when he was over in Iran for the second leg of the ACL final.
Nothing like that on this occasion. He's been a very, very busy man, as he'll like to tell anyone who will listen, that he's been flat out busy for this entire month. So, no, he's going very well. I'm working, closely with him now over the last couple of days as everything all comes together in the lead up to this final. So it's been good to catch up with him again because, like as we said before, the last time that I was on the podcast was 2013. That was one of the last times I actually saw Sean as well. I think, saw him at the Asian Cup 2015, but in 2013 stayed on his kitchen room floor in Japan for a week. So he's a very good man, Sean, and it's good to catch up with him again.
Wonderful stuff. Well, please send along my regards, and indeed Sam's as well. Obviously, I could send him a message myself, but yeah, if you could pass on my best to him, then that would be terrific. Before we wrap things up, Paul, let's just talk about the performance of the referee throughout the game. I mean, it's not something that I don't usually do. I mean, there was a couple of incidents, obviously, that drew attention to him surrounding the two Japanese goals. I mean, how did you think he went throughout the course of the game? For me personally, and not, I'm not biased because I'm Australian, I don't know too much about Mr. Beath and how he gets on in the A-League, whether he's very well respected or not. But for me, I thought he had a decent game, and obviously the couple of major decisions he had to make, I thought he was on the correct side of them.
It's good to see an Australian in the semi-final at least. I'm with you. I thought he did a good job. As with any referee, you're going to have people that disagree. I know he doesn't have the greatest reputation in Australia. There's certainly some that don't think he's up to the job. But I thought he's had a pretty good tournament overall. I thought he had a good game on Monday night. There were certainly no decisions that I disagreed with. I thought he had a good control of the game throughout. So, it's good to see an Australian in the semi-final, as I said, and one that put in a performance, unlike our other team who crashed out early.
Yes, indeed. And we might mention them briefly before we let you go, Paul. Sam, Paul's briefly mentioned that Genki Haraguchi made it 3-0 in second half stoppage time. I would argue redeeming himself after one of the worst performances I've ever seen anyone put in a Samurai Blue shirt. But perhaps I'm being a little bit harsh, but he most definitely redeemed himself, and hopefully will go into the final on Friday night Japan time with a bit of confidence, because for the preceding 89 and a half minutes, I thought he was absolutely woeful, and you could make a very strong case that he shouldn't make the starting 11 for the final. But I'm sure after his goal, he will. I don't know if you were as critical of him as I was.
Not quite as critical. I don't think he was brilliant. I mean, it's kind of been the same throughout the entire tournament. At Turkmenistan, he was anonymous for the first half, but then he kind of bails himself out with an assist to Osaka, and it was kind of similar here. I think he's definitely the weak link of that front four when Osaka is fit. Even though Minamino misses chances, at least he's getting the chances. He's kind of dynamic in his running. He's always involved, but Haraguchi kind of coasts through a game a little bit and then eventually does pop up with something, so that's going in his favour. But if Takashi Inoue was in any sort of form, then I'd be starting Inoue, but he can't get a game for his club side, and he looks rusty whenever he's played. So you're kind of limited options without Nakajima, because, I mean, the difference between what Nakajima brings and what Haraguchi has brought is incredible. I mean, yeah, he's a massive loss. He probably would have been the best player in the tournament, I'd argue, if Nakajima was here. So, yeah, it's a little bit poor on the left-hand side, but I don't think he was awful. I'm not going to say it was the worst performance I've ever seen, but yeah, I mean, he needs to step up in the final, because I'm sure he'll start. I don't think there's any question about that, but yeah, I'd like him to bring more to the table.
Yes, yeah, perhaps a little bit too critical on my part there. And as I say, yeah, he did definitely redeem himself with the goal right at the death. So, okay, Paul, let's try and move on to talk about the second semi-final between Qatar and the UAE, and what that result and Qatar's performance, what might mean for Japan and their prospects in the final. Two goals in each half saw the Qataris breeze past the UAE 4-0 on Tuesday night, with the sandals raining down from the stands and all sorts of stuff I can't even imagine happening on the terraces there. But obviously a very heated atmosphere, it goes without saying, and obviously one that was much more highly charged than the other game that you're at that we've just finished talking about on Monday night. But I don't know, are there echoes of Qatar coming into a game against Japan in a rich vein of form and looking extremely strong in a similar way to Iran did after the way they dispatched China and Oman before them? Is there an opportunity for Japan to show their class here against an untested Qatar at this stage of a major tournament? Obviously, they're going to be the hosts of the next World Cup, so they're going to have to get used to playing in big tournaments fairly quickly. We know they're off to the Copa America with Japan in the middle of 2019. But, this is obviously a stage that Qatar have never been at before. Are they ready to make that big leap and win a major tournament from what you've seen from them throughout the tournament so far?
Based on the evidence of what we've seen, They certainly look capable of that, but I thought the same thing about Iran too before they came up against Japan. So I think that's going to be their big test. You know, they've had a pretty good run this tournament. They haven't particularly played, probably apart from Korea. I'll give them that one. I forgot about that game. They hadn't particularly been tested against any great opposition, but they were against Korea, who is, you know, notionally one of the better teams in Asia, although I thought they had a pretty poor tournament themselves. But, you know, they were able to get through that. And the most impressive thing has been their defense for mine. A lot of the focus is on their attack, and they've got some fantastic players. They've got Al-Muez Ali up front, who's scored 8 goals this tournament, equaling the record by Ali Daei, and he could go on and break that in the final. Akram Afif, I think, is one of the best players on the continent. He's been involved in so many of those goals. He's provided the assist on, I think it was about 5 or 6 of the goals, and been involved in creating about 20 chances along the way, I think was the stat I saw today. So he's had a fantastic tournament and really taken his game to the next level, and his reputation will only get bigger and bigger to get closer to 2022. But for me, as I said, that there's a lot to like in their attack, but it's their defence as well. They're yet to concede a goal all tournament. They've got Bassam Al-Rawi at the back as well, who's been outstanding. Tarek Salman has had a good tournament. Abdul Karim Hassan on the left-hand side has been brilliant as well. I love watching him play and the way he just marauds forward and links up with the attack as well. So they've got such a strong foundation there. And what I like about this team, and you can't often say this with teams from West Asia, is this is a team that's been methodically built, and so often you see coaches get chopped and changed and barely given a chance to create a squad. Well, that's not the case here in Qatar. They've built this squad probably over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and all under the guidance of the one manager, and that's Felix Sanchez. He took this side from basically it's like the under-16s, then through to the under-19s, the under-22s, and now he's got the national team as well. He's been with them the whole way. A handful or more of these players have been with him on that journey the entire way as well. So this is a squad that's really been built for success and built for occasions such as this. They will get a good test now against Japan, but as I said, they got one similarly against Korea, and they were able to come through that one and get the win. So Japan's experience may hold them in good stead, and I still think that experience might just get them over the line in the final, but certainly I wouldn't be surprised if Qatar pulled it off, because having seen them control the game last night, UAE were poor last night, they have been all tournament, the win against Australia aside, UAE were poor, but Qatar just controlled that game with methodical ease, really, and just did what they had to do. They stepped up when they needed to and got the goals when they needed to, but they were in complete control from start to finish. And it was, as I said at the start, it was an interesting game to be at. It was certainly a hostile atmosphere for the Qataris. They certainly had no support in the stands. They had a smattering of supporters, mostly Omanis, who were coming along to lend their support. Otherwise, it was a completely hostile crowd. And as the goals rained in, the water bottles and the Coke bottles rained down, as did the footwear and the sandals as well. And you spotted people as you're leaving the ground with one sandal or one shoe missing on their feet. So it was an interesting night. Some ugly scenes, really, the stuff you never want to see at a football match. It was quite quite disgusting, if we're honest. It'll be interesting to see if any actions taken against them, because you know, the game had to get halted on a number of occasions while they cleaned up the bottles on the field. But that's the situation that we're in at the moment with the political tension that exists in this part of the world. It shouldn't spill over into football, but football and politics are so closely intertwined these days that it's hard not to. But it'll be interesting to see what kind of reception Qatar get when they step out onto the pitch on Friday night. I dare say it's going to be a very pro-Japan crowd at the Zayed Sports City Stadium.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, Paul. I mean, yeah, from the sounds of that, it sounds like it's going to be pretty much all Japan. So that will be a fascinating atmosphere. And we'll obviously wait and see how things have built throughout the afternoon. And yes, obviously you'll be there, so it'll be a wonderful occasion No doubt. Now, Sam, Paul was there, obviously, for the second semi-final to see Qatar win 4-0, but I know that you watched the game as well, so I'm not sure if that was the first full game you've seen from the Qataris or not throughout the tournament, but, yeah, from what you saw on display on Tuesday night, was there a lot to concern you in terms of how Japan might be able to cope with the Qataris? Well, you're not only the attack, obviously, that saw them score 4 goals, but obviously, yeah, how they might go about penetrating a defence that, as Paul has also mentioned, has not conceded. Obviously, that didn't deter Japan in the semis because Iran came in to that game in the same boat, but then shipped three again in varying circumstances. But yes, at the end of the day, Japan scored three legitimate goals. So, how did you take the second semi-final and how do you think, firstly, yeah, Japan will do against Qatar, but also the trouble that Qatar could possibly cause Japan the other way?
I think Qatar have been very impressive. I've only seen three games of them against Saudi Arabia, then Korea, and then the UAE. And I think, especially in the UAE and the Saudi Arabia game, especially with all the political tension that's around, they could easily get flustered, but they've been so composed in those situations with a hostile crowd, with the players, like Saudi players especially, were kind of getting in their faces, trying to ruffle feathers and whatnot. But they kept their composure, whereas Saudi Arabia, and then, as we saw yesterday, the UAE just kind of crumbled. Them and the crowd and the scenes, whatever, it was kind of like their Brazil 2014 moment. It all went wrong for them. But in the games that I've seen, Qatar have got these kind of two ways of playing. Against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they kind of imposed themselves on the opposition. They have three very good attacking players in Al-Haidos, in Al-Moez Ali and Afif, and they're going to cause problems for Japan, whereas Iran only really had Azmoun when Tirami was suspended, but so they kind of focused on this one angle of attack. But Qatar have got three different very good options going forward. But then, as we saw against Korea, when Korea were probably the stronger team on paper, Qatar were more than happy to sit back and soak up pressure. The defence has been watertight and the goalkeeper has performed superbly as well throughout the tournament. And then with the pace of Al-Moez Ali, etc. on the break, they can be a real handful. I don't think they've come up against the quality that Japan have, like Saudi Arabia, South Korea on paper should have done, but Son Heung-min was completely tired and they didn't really go through anyone else. Hwang In-byung wasn't terrific. Wee Jo had a poor game as well. So Korea were completely off the boil. But Japan, with Osako, Doan, Haraguchi, if he turns up, and Minamino, they've definitely got more options going forward that are going to cause a few more problems to Qatar. But the way Qatar have played throughout the tournament, they're going to be full of confidence. And I'm really happy for Qatar to have this sort of positivity going in, because since they were announced as the World Cup hosts, they've been bashed from all sides, but having no football history, they've only bought the World Cup and all this nonsense. But for Qatar to prove that they are a very good footballing nation, and even just to get to this Asian Cup final, I think it's going to really boost Qatari football going forward, and I hope this kind of continues for the next 3-4 years before we get into that World Cup. Yeah, they've been kind of really refreshing to see this Qatari football, and yeah, I think it's going to be a really good final. I'd still edge towards Japan. I think they've got a little bit too much quality, but I don't think you can rule out Qatar at all.
All right, so I think Sam's just given his prediction there, Paul, and you are the neutral observer here, the Asian football expert from the Asian Game Podcast, and obviously all the other outlets that you work for around the game in Asia. So you're neutral here, and yes, you have a strong outlook on all things Asian football. So whether the rise of Qatar in this tournament has been a massive surprise to you or not, I'm not sure. But when it comes to Friday night, if I can pin you down, how do you think it's going to turn out at the end of the day? Will Japan's experience for the nation, but yeah, this is a legitimately new squad under Moriyasu, of course, so a lot of players in this squad have never been in this position before, but whether you think Japan's, in inverted commas, big game experience will hold them in better stead in the final, or whether this is Qatar's time, how do you see the final going?
I think it's going to be a close match, and the match that I think we can most draw parallels to is probably the match between Qatar and Korea as well. And You know, Korea notionally has the big game experience as well, but I think Qatar handled themselves really well in that game. So I'm not sure necessarily they'll be overawed as such. The Japan certainly got the big game experience. And when you look at some of the plays in that squad, as you said, it is a relatively new squad, but you look at some of the guys like Yoshida and Nagatomo, and you know, these guys have been there for quite some time now. Even guys like Genki Haraguchi and Yuya Osako, you know, these guys have been in and around the squad for, you know, a good 4, 5, 6 years. So they've got that experience of playing at high levels, of going to World Cups, of being at Asian Cups. So it's not unusual for them to be in this position. I really like this Qatar side. I made the prediction on Twitter and on the Asian Game podcast that we did before the tournament that for me they were really one of the dark horses. My prediction to win the tournament was actually South Korea, and that one didn't turn out to be the case. But I did say to Scott that I think South Korea will win the tournament, but I thought Qatar would go far in the tournament as well, and probably didn't expect they'd make a final. I thought maybe a semi-final appearance, but certainly haven't been surprised by how well they've gone. This has been a team that I've had an eye on for a little bit of a couple of years now, and I really like the look of this team and how they've really developed under Felix Sanchez, and I like the fact that they've given him the chance to take this team on, given that he's developed them from a young age. It so often is the case, and I hope it's not the case after this tournament as well, as they look forward to 2022, that they look to just bring in a big-name manager and the allure that that brings, because I think he's done such a really good job in building this squad that he deserves the chance to take this team through on the journey to 2022. And I think the players are responding to him. So, as I said, at the start of the tournament, I said Qatar would do really well. I'm going to edge towards Japan just because of that big game experience that some of their players have got. They've probably got a little bit more, in their game than Qatar do. Because I think if Japan can sort of nullify the threats that they have in sort of Al-Muez Ali and Akram Afif, I'm just not sure whether they've got the depth in their squad to be able to cover for those guys if they don't play it at their optimum level. So I'm going to edge just towards Japan, but it's very much toss of a coin stuff. But I'm going to edge towards Japan at this stage.
All right, then. Well, yeah, it promises to be a fascinating final on Friday night. Japan time, and yeah, I think, is it about 6 o'clock UAE time, Paul? So it'll be yeah, a wonderful occasion, and I'm sure a full house. And yeah, it'll be, as we've said, it'll be really interesting to see if the majority of the support will be behind Japan. It sounds like it will be. All right, well, so Paul, you've been so generous with your time, and before you go though, I just did want to ask you a couple of things about the tournament as a whole. Obviously, the second semi-final featured a matchup between Qatar and the UAE, who had knocked out South Korea, as we've mentioned several times in the last few minutes, and also Australia, respectively, in the quarterfinals. And obviously, for Paul and myself as Australians, that loss to the UAE was a real stinger, especially as we saw how inept they were, the Emiratis were, in the semi-final when even though it was definitely Australia, certainly didn't set the world on fire throughout the tournament. We would have liked to have thought, to Paul, I'm sure, that Australia would have given Qatar a better game in the semi-final. So specifically about the South Koreans and the Australians, Paul, I mean, these are earlier than expected exits from the tournament, no doubt. What lessons do you think, if any? Obviously, these tournaments only come around every 4 years, but we've got a World Cup qualifying cycle to begin in the next year or so. Yeah, what lessons do you think will both of them take away in terms of preparation for a major tournament? Do they need to clean house and bring through a new generation, as for the most part, Hajime Moriyasu has done with Japan? Or do you think, any lessons might be saved for later, and it'll just be same old for the South Koreans and the Aussies going forward?
If I focus on Australia first of all, I think the lesson is probably maybe a little bit more humility and respect towards Asian football, and that's something we've said for a long time now. I didn't particularly like the comments from Graham Arnold pre-tournament and during the tournament when he said that we expect to win all seven games and we expect to dominate the opposition. I know he has his mind coach now that that likes to play up to this, expecting to do stuff, and it just doesn't fly really well. You can have all of that talk internally, I think, but there's no need to externalise that, and I think that just gives adds fuel to the fire for the opposition who take it as disrespect. So I think Australia just need to be careful and mindful of that. I think Australia were a lot of teams, but I think Australia in particular, because they don't have necessarily the depth that they've had in the past, were hurt by injuries. When you look at the loss to the UAE, Tom Rogic was out suspended. I think he would have made a big difference, but they're also missing with injury their two most creative players as well, in Aaron Moy and Daniel Arzani, who missed the tournament. So when you add Tom Rogic to that as well, that's the three most creative players that Australia has, and I think that just really really had an impact on the side, because they were struggling to create chances. They had still had some decent players out on the pitch, but they weren't creating clear chances and regular chances on goal that they should be able to convert. So I think when you add those players back into the side, then I think Australia's still there and thereabouts. I don't think they were ever going to go on and win this tournament as such, but they'll still be right in contention for Korea. We've already seen a couple of their players announce their international retirements. We saw Kuja Chol and Ki Sung-yung have both announced today their international retirements. So there will certainly be a little bit of a shake-up with the Koreans going forward as well. I think they just need to – they've got some players to come into this side as well. Someone like Kwon Chang-hoon, who's a young striker who's making a name for himself in France. He was injured for this tournament as well. He was injured for the World Cup. He's a player I particularly like. Nam Tae-hee as well. They probably lacked a little bit of creativity as well. They've got some really good, young, exciting players that are just starting to emerge over in Spain as well. So they'll start to emerge as this next four-year World Cup cycle comes along. So there's lessons to be learned for both sides. I think Korea in particular will go through a little bit more of a squad overhaul, just given the fact that they've already had some players announce their international retirements. I think Australia's squad will be relatively settled. Mark Milligan, I expect, to probably announce his retirement shortly, or at least over the next 12 months, may continue on for a little bit and just transition out. I think once you add those injured players back into the side, Martin Boyle is another one I forgot to mention. All of a sudden, you know, the attack has a little bit more depth about it and a little bit more variety as well. So I think going forward, both teams are still going to be in a good position. I certainly think Australia's going to find it tougher than they ever have to qualify for this World Cup. They were Asia's fifth best team last time around. I don't think they've significantly improved that position. Qatar is now pushing up as well to join that lot. We'll wait to see what happens with Saudi Arabia, because they're always so up and down. But yeah, certainly I think Australia is going to have a tough time qualifying for the next World Cup. And we'll see what happens there. But yeah, I think there's some interesting times ahead for both Japan and Korea, and we'll see how Australia and Korea, and we'll see how they fare as that World Cup qualifying gets started later this year.
All right, so we'll finish our check on the Asian Cup with obviously the final coming up on Friday night with something that Paul mentioned towards the end of his previous answer, the next cycle of World Cup qualifying. So I'd like to get both of your thoughts on the teams that you've seen throughout this obviously expanded Asian Cup tournament at 24 nations for the first time ever, and obviously with Qatar qualifying for 2022 automatically as hosts. So what is the major takeaway for both of you in terms of, is there an inverted commas minor nation or developing footballing nation that has caught your eye and that you think might become real threats of upsetting the, again, in inverted commas, big five of Japan, South Korea, Australia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, who four of them have qualified for the last goodness knows how many World Cups from Asia. So for the next World Cup qualifying cycle, Sam, from what you've seen in this tournament, is there a developing nation that you think is a realistic chance of nicking one of those World Cup qualifying spots?
Yeah, I mean, it might be tough for this one, but definitely the one after, I'd go for Vietnam. I think they've got such a good, exciting young side. They're doing very well at youth tournaments, and they were very impressive in this tournament. I mean, they lost a few games. They only got through the groups by disciplinary points. But even so, I thought they were very good against Iraq when losing 3-2. Very good against Yemen when they won. Gave Iran a decent enough game. And then played quite well against Japan. They're very well organised. They're very good in possession. They were quite prudent with possession. They took the game to Japan, especially in the first half. They still need to get a bit more tournament experience, a bit more composure in front of goal. But I definitely think there are seeds there for Vietnam to become a very decent Asian nation going forward. And then the other team would be Iraq. I thought Iraq played very well in this tournament, especially in the group stages. They've got a lot of decent players, Iraq. Mohamed Ali, I think the striker for them, a very young striker. He's got bids from all over Europe by the looks of it, without really being allowed to be released by his club. But I think like Juventus, I think, were one of the teams in for him, I read. So I think there's definitely quality there with Ali Adnan as well, kind of the more experienced player in that team. But those were the two kind of younger nations that kind of, in terms of the players that they had at this tournament, that could really kick on over the next couple of years. And then maybe you've got Thailand. I know they started this tournament dreadfully against India, but they've got very good players that are now making their way into more Asian leagues, especially the J League. We've had Titipan has also got a move up to Oita Trinita, so he joins Chantip and Tiraton, and then Tirasil had a decent enough season with San Freche. So I think those three nations are kind of going to be there or thereabouts and maybe pushing towards that final qualifying place. But especially when the tournament expands to 48 teams, whether that is for Qatar or for the tournament afterwards, I think these sorts of nations will be the ones that qualify on a more regular basis.
All right, terrific stuff. And, same to you, Paul. Which countries have caught your eye?
I think before I answer that, I guess it really depends, especially for 2022, as to what FIFA does with the tournament, as to whether they keep it 32 or they do expand it to 48 teams, because that will then depend on how many slots there are available for Asian teams. But certainly there are a couple that caught my eye. I agree with what Sam said about Vietnam. They're a really strong emerging nation. They've made it to the quarterfinals on this occasion. They did well in the Asian Games. They made the final of the under-23 tournament last year as well. They've won the Suzuki Cup. So they've had a really good 12 months, and they've got a really good crop of players coming through. So hopefully they can really step up their game and do what Thailand did in the last round of World Cup qualifying, get to the final stage. And even though Thailand, you know, struggled in the end there, hopefully Vietnam can kick in a little further. I certainly agree with Iraq as well. They've got a lot of exciting young talent. One that I'm hopeful for is one that's been there or thereabouts over the last probably decade or so, but never quite managed to get the job done, and that's Uzbekistan. I think they've got a really good crop of young players coming through as well. They won that AFC Under-23s championship last year against Vietnam in that final, and we saw some of those players really step up in this tournament as well. Aldor Shomurodov was one of the leading strikers early in the tournament, and he's got a lot to like about him as well. Jevol Sidikov in midfield as well is an exciting young player. So for me, they've got a good mix of experience and youth that are starting to come through. And as I said, they've been there or thereabouts over the last decade or so, but they always managed to find a way to fall at the final hurdle. They pushed Australia all the way. They probably should have pushed them further. I think they sat back a little bit too much in the second half. They really threatened Australia in that first half. So I think this team can really go on and step up, and it'd be good to see them finally get to a World Cup that they've probably deserved at least one appearance over the last decade or so. So they're for one for me to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, terrific. Some great shouts there from Sam and Paul. And yeah, I've been waiting for Uzbekistan to really get their act together for about a decade now. So yeah, it's just about time, I reckon, for them to pull up their, tighten up their bootstraps, or however that saying goes, and finally get to a World Cup. All right, well, that's absolutely fantastic, guys. I don't think you'll get a more thoroughly interesting chat about the Asian Cup with a Japan bent anywhere else on the internet. Absolutely fantastic stuff from both Paul and Sam. Paul, I haven't warned you about this, but we're actually going to let you go, and Sam and I are going to chat for 10 minutes or so about some of the major storylines from the J1 off-season. So for now, we will let you go. I'll let the listeners know, of course, that they can follow Paul on Twitter at PaulWilliams_85 and check out the latest episodes of the Asian Game podcast and Paul's writing here, there and everywhere. All of his credits are in his Twitter bio. He's one of the busiest men in Asian football, and for you to take so much of your time out of getting ready for this huge final on Friday night is massive, and I really appreciate it, Paul. Thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the end of the tournament, and you've done a power of work throughout it, so you should be proud of everything you've done, and as I say, thanks very much for your time on the podcast.
Always a pleasure, Ben. It's great to have the pod back for 2019. Look forward to a big season ahead.
Terrific stuff. Yeah, hopefully it won't be 6 years before we speak again on J-Talk the next time. So my thanks again to Paul Williams. A quick hit of music, and then Sam and I will be back, as I said, to talk about some of the major off-season storylines in J1. Back in a moment. All right, thanks again to Paul for taking so much time out of his preparations for the Asian Cup final. Absolutely fantastic to get his thoughts throughout part one. And yes, Sam, it's been a somewhat interesting off season for a number of J1 clubs. As with the Asian Cup and the early stages of it, I can't say I've been keeping a massive amount of interest going in what's been happening transfer wise, but there have been a couple of notable ones, most definitely, and a certain London Olympics top scorer joining the reigning J1 champions, indeed two-time J1 champions, certainly did raise my eyebrows. So Leandro Damião arrives at Todoroki, and certainly an interesting name, and adding to the stable of Brazilian strikers plying their trade in the J-League.
Yeah, very, very good signing. I'm amazed he hasn't signed for Spurs, because I think he was linked with them for about 5 years consistently. But he's finally made it to Japan instead. I think it was the kind of one area of the team where Kawasaki could have strengthened, because they were playing Kobayashi up front, and I think his best position is out on the right wing. So if you've got this focal point in Damião, I think that's it's a superb little signing. I think he scored quite a few goals already in pre-season, so hopefully there's a link up there and a quick understanding. So I don't think he's quite at the level that Joe was in Brazil, so I wouldn't necessarily be predicting a 50-goal haul this season, but I think he definitely adds a lot to this Kawasaki attacking quartet, as it would be. So I think that's a very good signing. Otherwise, they've kind of picked up a few kind of squad players. Yamamura will definitely add depth. Mawatari at the back kind of comes in for El Senio, but I don't think that's the greatest switch for them. And then a couple of other lesser-known Brazilians in Maguinho from Villanova in Serie B, and Heisiel, I think that's the pronunciation I'm going for. Two kind of younger defenders from the second tier. There's potential there, but you never really know with those sorts of players. How do they settle into the team? I don't think either are necessarily going to start. Maguinho might start at right back, and if he's anywhere near as good as El Senio has been for Kawasaki, then that would be great for them. But I think that might be a dodgy area, but Damião is the key signing for Kawasaki, and I think it just gives an extra layer to their already pretty good attack. So I think Kawasaki are fairly well set going into the season. The depth should hopefully help them in the Asian Champions League, because they've got a battle on that front as well, and they haven't really been able to do both in the last couple of seasons, so hopefully they can have a quick start in that competition as well.
Indeed, yeah. So, Kawasaki look frightening, to be blunt, with, Damião joining Kobayashi, Hiroyuki Abe, etc. up front, and most definitely will be the team to beat in 2019. A couple of other Kanto giants have had mixed off seasons, I would suggest, Sam. For Urawa, they're retooling under Osvaldo Oliveira continues. Two important names, one at either end of the pitch, could have a huge impact on Reds, obviously, as they look to make an impact on the ACL again this season after winning the Emperor's Cup. So, in particular, obviously, I'm referencing Kenyu Sugimoto and Ryosuke Yamanaka.
Yeah, very good signings. I think they've kind of cleared out a lot of dead wood that was in that squad, and then Sugimoto will kind of compete with Fabrizio and Kuroki up front. So there's three very good strikers there. Hopefully Sugimoto has the form that he's displayed in 2017 rather than 2018. But if they get him to that level again, that's a superb signing for Urawa. And Yamanaka was arguably the breakout star from last season on the kind of left wing back for Yokohama. He should take over from Tomoya Ugajin on that left-hand side. So I think that's another very good sign. There's so much depth now into this squad. They've also signed another Brazilian from Portimonense, kind of played with Fabrizio back at Portimonense in Portugal. He's called Everton Pereira, a very strong central midfielder, can go forward. So especially when you've got you've got Abe kind of coming towards the end of his career and Kashiwagi maybe slightly coming towards it, Everton Pereira can bring a few more legs into that midfield, a lot more depth. So I think they've got a really strong squad, and I'd be surprised if they're not right up there this season.
Indeed, yeah, it looks very promising for Reds as we training camps continue with about a month to go before J1 kicks off. But on the flip side, the reigning Asian champions, the Kashima Antlers, Sam, a very much a low key off season from them, and whether they're just keeping their powder dry for a couple of big announcements, I'm not sure, but it's slightly uncharacteristic. That usually they would have made an impact signing by now.
Yeah, especially with the players that they've lost. Genshoji was always going to leave, and he eventually did to Toulouse. But then Daigo Nishi went across to Kobe, so that's two very, very good defenders they've let go and not really replaced them with anyone. The names brought in were Shoito from Yokohama Striker and Ryohei Shirasaki, so there's not a lot at the back. And you can't really rely on Uchida to be your main right back because of his injury problems. I don't think he can play week in, week out, so there's a few gaps to fill at the back for Kashima. And I mean, hopefully for them, they've still got, 3 weeks before the start of the season, a bit longer for the window. But I think they're a little light at the back, one or two injuries, and there's not a lot there. So, yes, at the moment, it's shaping up to be a tough season for Kashima.
Yeah, and of course, they'd lost Naomichi Ueda after the World Cup. So, looking a bit light in defence are Antlers, but they do tend to cope, don't they, Sam? So, yeah, we certainly won't be writing them off in the pre-season. And, we mentioned that Daigo Nishi headed over to Kobe, and the Galactico project at Vissel obviously continued with the signing of David Vija, which we knew before last season finished. And I think, Sam, you were on the podcast the week that news broke. As we speak, I believe that Vissel are still on their American tour. I'm not sure, to be brutally honest, how that's going, but how do you think that Vissel are shaping up? Obviously, they are one of the great pretenders of J1. They've never really posed much of a threat at the sharp end of the table. I mean, Vija, we know, is coming towards the end of his career, as Andres Iniesta is, and arguably Lucas Podolski is as well. But, I mean, do these three big names have a big season? Well, if they can all manage to stitch it all together, the three of them together could be obviously something special. But we've known before with Galactico projects in the J League that it doesn't always work out. So their other business, Nishi included, do you think they're in decent shape for at least a crack at the top six? Say, we probably don't want to be too optimistic, but how are Vissel shaping up? Do you think?
I mean, on paper, when those three are in the same team, you'd expect them to have a very good season. I mean, the first friendly was a 0-0 draw, so that's not the greatest start for them. But I think that at the moment, there's still a lot of time left to get more players in, but I think they're too top-heavy. I mean, there's a lot reliant. They're brilliant, probably, going forward with Villa, Iniesta, Podolski, and then they brought in Hattori Yamaguchi, who didn't have a great season last year, but it definitely has quality. So, like, a midfield three of Mita, Yamaguchi, and Iniesta is as good as you're going to get in the J-League. But still, their problem is going to be at the back. They're going to rely on Maekawa in goal, who's quite a inexperienced goalkeeper. He plays out from the back quite nicely, but there's still work to be done with him. They've got Daigo Nishi at the right, on the right, but I mean, Hatsuse is coming from Gamba for the left back role. I don't think he's much of an upgrade on Tiraton at all. I think he's got potential, but he's not there at the moment. And there's not really much in the centre back department either. The defence was atrocious last season, and really, I don't think it's improved greatly going into this season. They were linked with Martin Caceres from Lazio, but he's now gone to Juventus, so that's they've missed out on him. They were also linked with Adriano, the former Barcelona fullback, but not a lot has developed there either. So I think they're probably two defensive signings away from really having a crack at top six, top four. But as it stands at the moment, I think there's a little way to go.
All right then. Well, yeah, it's always fascinating with Kobe, and we'll wait and see how they progress through the rest of pre-season and how they're shaping up for the start of the season. So, Sam, yeah, we've mentioned a few clubs already, and this obviously doesn't pass for a J1 season preview. There will be at least one full episode of the podcast dedicated to that. We were simply, just talking about a couple of the signings or players changing clubs that have caught our eye over the off-season. Is there another club or a couple that you wanted to mention before we sign off on this episode?
I'd probably go for one of the newly promoted sides in Matsumoto, who have just made an absolute raft of signings. There's so many, especially in the attacking midfield position. They've got Taro Sugimoto, who was on loan at Tokushima Vortis from Kashima Antlers last season. He's a very good player, but then he'll be with Daisen Maeda and Serginho in that role, so there's a lot of quality there. And they also signed a Brazilian striker in Leandro Pereira from Chapecoense, who looks like he could be a really good player as well. He's come pretty highly rated from Brazil, so I think there's goals in that team. They've also kind of got a few little good defensive acquisitions. Eduardo came in from Kawasaki, obviously not used much at Kawasaki, but he's a very good J1 defender. So I think they've built a really good squad here, and I think it gives them as good a chance as any to stay up this season. And maybe the other team I'd look at is Nagoya, because they've not gone to get a Joe this season, but they had like five or six very good players in the squad last year, but kind of couldn't piece it all together. But this year they've kind of made really sensible, experienced signings. Kazuhiko Chiba from Sanfrecce comes in at the back, as does Yoshida from Tosus, two very good experienced players. And then Takuji Yonemoto has left FC Tokyo, like the stalwart at Tokyo, and he comes into the midfield as well as Mateus from Omiya, I think, is going to be their most exciting signing. He's scored plenty of goals for Omiya, both in J1 when they were there and in J2 last year. So I think there's a lot of attacking impetus there, but now with the experience and a bit more know-how at the back, so they shouldn't be quite as ridiculously open as they had been last season. And maybe now they can sort of get a bit more consistency and push towards the topper end of the table rather than facing a relegation battle.
Indeed. All right. Well, yeah, we don't have a goal prediction for Joe from Scott McIntyre for the 2019 season yet, but yeah, for the time being, let's presume that he thinks he's going to score 50 again. So yeah, some of those off-season acquisitions could go a long way towards Joe living up to that billing. And yeah, from a Tokyo perspective, it was a sad day to see Takuji Yonemoto leave after all he's been through at the club, three devastating knee injuries, but also the glory of the 2009 Nabisco Cup win when we were the underdogs against Kawasaki, and he scored the opening goal, a blazing finish from 30 yards through the fingertips of Eiji Kawashima. That was arguably his finest day in an FC Tokyo shirt, and probably my favourite as a fan of the club. And yeah, a sad day when so much dead wood has clogged up the bench at FC Tokyo for so many years. They've finally gone some way to getting some of them off the books, but yeah, for me personally, it was hard to see Yonemoto leave, but every FC Tokyo supporter wishes him all the best on his new adventure down in Nagoya, where of course he joins Yuichi Maruyama, his long-time teammate, who is now a stalwart at centre-back for Grampus. office. All right, well, yeah, that's, as I say, a very brief look at some of the clubs making waves in the J1 off-season. Sam, I left that open for you to take that wherever you wanted, and I knew you would be well prepared, so thank you very much for your thoughts on all of those off-season moves. As I said earlier, we will definitely have at least one J1 season preview episode of the podcast before the big kickoff towards the end of February, and even thinking about maybe breaking it up regionally and trying to get a couple of in-depth previews of the new top flight season into your ears before the new J1 season gets going. But for now, yeah, keep following along on Twitter at JTalkPod for updates on when our next episode will be. Hopefully it will be early next week after Japan have lifted the Asian Cup, but we'll have to wait and see what happens on the Friday night. Hajime Moriyasu has 10 wins and one draw from his 11 games in charge of the Samurai Blue. Let's hope he makes it 11 and a draw from 12 after Friday night against Qatar. I mentioned our Twitter handle. I mentioned Paul's at the end of part one. Of course, if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you're probably already following Sam on Twitter at FRSoccerSam. But if you are not, please get that sorted sharpish. Sam, thank you so much for your time. It's great to get you back on the podcast, our first of 2019, and hopefully the first of many appearances by your good self. As always, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and good luck for the podcast for the rest of the season.
All right. Well, yeah, you're going to be on a lot of them, mate. So, yeah, good luck to yourself as well. All right. Well, yeah, that is it for the first JTalk podcast of 2019. My thanks once again to Sam Robson and Paul Williams, and to you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you again soon. Bye for now.
The JTalk podcast.